session number 18622, Reel 1.
Jim Brand, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Tynmouth in South Devon.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Tynmouth?
Shared between Tynmouth and Saltash down in Cornwall. My father was in the service, and he left the service in 1930, went to pension in 1930, then we came back to Tynmouth to live again.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
14 years old. I was 14 when I left school.
So you left school in 1936?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I went to work for international stores. I was apprenticed to them as a grocery assistant. The headquarters was in London in Mitre Square, and the parent company was called Cairley & Tongue.
Is that the line of work you were doing when war was declared?
Yes, I was still working for the same firm.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
No, I did not. It was a Sunday, of course. And on that Sunday, I spent walking on Little Holden. And it wasn't until I came back to my mother's home, my mother's home, that she told me that the war had started. So I didn't hear the speech at all. I heard that my mother told me that the war had started.
How did you feel when you heard the news?
Well, my first reaction was, good, now I can join the Navy. I don't have to go to this blasted job anymore. I hated it.
But why could you not have joined the Navy without war being declared?
Oh, I'd got past the age when you could join as a boy. And I don't think my father was very keen on me joining as a boy anyway. He wouldn't have minded me joining once I became 18. But he didn't like the idea of me joining the service as a boy.
Why was that?
I don't know. He joined himself as a boy. So I'm not sure what he never made clear his why he felt that way about it. I suppose he was being rather more protective to me than his parents were of him. I don't know.
Had he had a bad experience?
No. He did very well. He loved the service. He retired in 1930, as I said, as a master at arms. Of course, he was recalled for the war again. He was recalled in 1939.
So did you then go about joining the Navy?
When I heard on the Sunday that the war had started, I sat down at home and rode away immediately to join the service, yes.
What was the result of that?
Well, I went for a medical up at Bristol. And at that time, they were only taking permanent service people. And I had a weak right eye. And so they wouldn't, I more or less failed the exam because I had a weak right eye. I still wanted to join the service anyway. So I applied again a bit later on. Once they were taking in hostilities only ratings, I decided to have another try.
When was that?
Oh, it'd be about 12 months later, I suppose.
Had the war affected you in Tynmouth at all before you joined?
Oh, the bombing hadn't really started at Tynmouth by the time I left Tynmouth. Funnily enough, very early in the war, I think it might even have been the first bombs dropped here were dropped one each side of the pier on a Sunday, and caused quite a bit. It caused a lot of damage to the pier glass and things. Didn't do any damage. Nobody was killed or anything. But that was the only bombs we saw. And I did see a bomber fly up the River Teen on one occasion. And I saw that bomber drop the bombs that nearly hit Newton Abbot Railway Station. That was on a Sunday. And funnily enough, since I've been married to my wife, Eileen, I've now found out she was playing tennis in the park close to the railway station and had to take cover under a wheelbarrow because of it. I didn't even know her in those days.
Did you see the attack on Tynmouth Pier?
No, I didn't. I heard it, but I didn't see it.
So the war didn't really affect you very much before you joined up?
No, not at all. Because it was rationing and things like that, and life became a bit difficult working in a shop because everything was restricted. But apart from that, it didn't really make any difference to me. The job went on just the same as it had in peacetime, and we had customers to serve, and I used to go out on a round to take orders, which was delivered sometime later that week, and then the next week when I went there, they used to pay me for last week's groceries and give me an order for to be supplied again, you know, in that particular week. And I'm still doing that right up until the time I actually joined the service in 1941.
What kind of foods were restricted in the shop?
Well, practically everything by that time. Bacon, cheese, butter. Nearly everything was restricted. Everything was in very short supply by then. It's a bit difficult to remember exactly now, but because all the manufacturers were restricted in how much sugar they could get, how much of almost any raw material they could get to make these like biscuits and stuff like that, everything was in short supply.
Was even bread short?
No, not at that time. In fact, I think bread was probably one of the things that they kept going. You know, they didn't seem to get short of bread at all. But I must admit that the quality of the bread dropped it dreadfully during the war. It had no keeping qualities at all. And if you did keep it for a few days, it went green. You know, there was, I don't know what they were putting in the bread, but the quality of the bread was very poor. By comparison with what we eat today, I mean.
Did it taste worse?
Yes, it did. There was something about it. As a matter of fact, if you kept the loaf, if you didn't eat it within the first 2 days, when I was in the service, I noticed it more than when I was at home. But the bread would have a sour taste to it, you know.
Can you tell me about joining up in the Navy now, please?
Yes, I joined on the 1st of May, 1941. I went on that day. I had to travel to Plymouth to the museum in Tavistock Road, where I met up with two more chaps who were joining the Navy the same as I was. They gave us some railway warrants. We caught a train from North Road Station to London. We spent the night that night in the Union Jack Club in Waterloo, and the next day we travelled up to Skegness and joined the Navy at Skegness, HMS Royal Arthur.
What was that like?
I enjoyed it. Even though it was May, it was very cold on that east coast at the time. I remember that. Where they sent us for the first night, the chalets were jolly cold. In fact, they used the sailors had a nickname for that particular row of chalets. They called it Pneumonia Row.
Did anybody catch pneumonia?
No, I don't think so. But it was jolly cold. It was jolly cold.
Why did you personally enjoy it so much?
Oh, I don't know. It was different. I was always a very active sort of lad, really, and just the extra exercise, and I don't know, everything about it was, I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
How did the people in charge treat the new recruits?
Very well indeed. That was one thing I found out later in life as I went along. The entry system in the service didn't alter at all in peacetime or in war. Everybody that joined the service more or less joined exactly the same, even in peacetime, as they did during the war. They did so many weeks being assimilated into the service and learning how to drill, square bashing, if you like, and then the rudiments of discipline and one thing and another, before they went on to be given a professional course of whatever branch they were in. And it's still like that during the war.
Were you asked to do anything on the basic training that you found difficult to do?
No.
Was it just square bashing?
No, there were other things as well. Which one thing I found rather peculiar, they trained people to row a boat. Well, I've been rowing all my life. I found that most peculiar, to be taught how to pull an oar. That really... But it was obvious that a lot of the other chaps that had joined with me had no idea, hardly know which end of the oar to stick in the water. But still, that's the way it was. But and the other thing, of course, was that the whalers that we were using were secured fore and aft in the swimming pools. And so to allow you to pull the oar through the water, they had big holes drilled through the blade of the oars. So the water would go through and you wouldn't break the oar. But it felt most peculiar, being used to rowing a boat, most of my life, ever since I knew how to, almost, to go there and experience that was a bit peculiar.
What happened to you after Royal Arthur?
I was sent to Devonport. Then I went to Impregnable for a while, which was a new entry camp for signalmen and sparkers, the telegraphists. Then I went back into the barracks again and was eventually sent to a Flower Class Corvette. That was HMS Mallow.
As a signaller?
No. I was in the... Sorry, I should have told you that. I joined the supply branch. I was what they call a supply assistant.
What did that involve?
Well, you dealt with all the stores, the victualling stores... Well, any sort of everything that was required in the service went through your department. Everything from food, tools, everything that you can think of. Clothing, bedding, mess utensils, cooking equipment. You dealt with everything.
And did you do this job aboard HMS Mallow?
Yes, I was what they call the... I was in charge of the victualling stores. On board the Mallow was still what they call the system of feeding called canteen messing, which meant that the sailors had an allowance, each mess had an allowance per man per day, which they were allowed to spend either in the canteen run by the NAFI or in the store that I ran. They would put in a chit each day for what they required from the store. Those chits were valued and then debited against each mess. And come the end of the month, I would tell them how much money they owed the Navy for the food they'd bought. And so would the canteen. And then they would either have some money left over, which was given to the mess, or they owed some money which they had to pay us. And that was all done through the pay office.
Did it cause any disputes?
Never. The sailors were very, very happy with canteen messing. They enjoyed it. I don't know whether they were brainwashed into it or not, but they certainly preferred it to being fed what they called general mess.
When did you join HMS Mallow? About?
Woo-hoo. Let me see. It would be about, I'm trying to think, it was early in 1942, early in 42, but I can't remember the exact date now to save my life. But I didn't stay on her all that long. I left her again, for some reason or other, they sent a chap up to relieve me, and there was two of us on board, And they decided that we were overborne by that time. Whether it was a mistake or no, I'm not certain. But I got sent back to the naval barracks at Devonport in the August.
Did you not do any voyages in Mallow?
Oh, yes. Just, you know, more or less almost. We went on a few convoys, a bit of convoy work, but it wasn't any really long distance. We didn't go up to North Russia or anything like that. You know, we did mostly out of Liverpool in Northern Ireland.
Was it a very seaworthy ship?
They were the Flora class corvettes were very seaworthy, but were absolute pigs to live in. They as they used to say, they would roll in a heavy dew. They were, you know, they were built. They looked like a beer barrel cut in half long ways. They were based on one of the old trawler designs.
So what did that mean for the people aboard?
Well, not a lot really. She was pretty dry. We didn't ship a lot of water down in the mess decks or anything like that. So when you went to sea, where people just join it first, they'd probably have a few days being seasick and then they'd get over it and they were all right after that. Nearly everybody was the same.
But you said it was a pig to live in.
No, I'm talking about when she was at sea rolling. I'm talking about as a sea boat. The things were terrible at sea for rolling. And, you know, they used to roll something dreadful and pitch and, you know, they were terrible like that. But like everything else, the stomach got used to it, you know.
Did you run into the enemy at all in the ship?
No, we didn't. We did open fire on an aircraft on one occasion, but that was all.
What was your action station aboard ship?
I was in a magazine.
What would you have to do there?
Well, if they needed ammunition for the, you know, for the gun, I had to send it up.
How did you do that?
Well, there was two ways of doing it, mostly by hand. You'd lift, push, you know, you'd lift it up through the hatch, and somebody else took it from you there and carried it, you know, put it up the next deck and so on like that until it reached the upper deck and was taken to the gun. Of course, they had ready-use ammunition lockers on deck, so there was never any need. In fact, I don't remember us ever. I've been closed up lots of times, but never went into action that needed me to do anything like that. We did it as a drill, but not in earnest.
Was the ammunition heavy?
Not particularly, no. I can't remember the exact weight of it now, but it wasn't that heavy. I mean, the shell and charge were all in one, you know. It wasn't like the big guns that used to. The shell used to go up separately, then the charge would be put in afterwards and things like that. This was just, or even a separate brass cylinder with the explosives in. It was all in one piece, and so, you know, it was easy that way.
Was it dangerous to handle?
No, not really. No, it was. I wouldn't say that, you know, unless the thing was hit on the percussion cap. It was as safe as houses and no danger at all. In fact, I've seen one of them dropped and it fell across a chap's hip and literally bent like that. A chap was stood in the magazine when it happened. And it came from the deck above through the hatch and hit him across the thigh because it put him in sick bay, but the ammunition didn't explode.
But the shell bent?
The casing bent, the brass casing bent. That wasn't on that particular ship. That was a later ship.
Was HMS Mallow a happy ship?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it was. I remember that the coxswain was a chap called Brown. Part of my duties, really, as a Jack Dusty, as we called the supply readiness in the Navy, the Jack Dusty, was to serve out the rum. Now, that didn't meet with Coxswain Brown's approval, not one little bit. He liked to issue the rum, so I had to give way on that. He insisted on serving the rum out.
Why did he take that attitude?
I got no idea. Perhaps he liked a little extra drop of rum himself and he could fix himself a drop that way. I don't know.
Did the Jack Dusters usually fiddle it?
It's been known to happen, yes.
Why are they called Jack Dusters?
Oh, they used to work in the stores and their overalls and that used to be covered with tea dust or something like that, you know, from working in the storerooms. It's a real old naval expression, Jack Dusty. Goes back a lot, long time before, ever before this, you know, 39-45 war. They're still known as Jack Dusty today.
Anything else that happened to you aboard HMS Marlowe?
No, not really. I left her eventually in Rosyth. I travelled back to Devonport with a stoker and two leading stokers. I can't even remember their name now. One of them was a big Irishman, I remember. But that was a ghastly trip. We left Rosyth on Sunday morning before lunch. We were taken up to Dunfermline Railway Station in a tilly, a utility van thing. And our kit was pushed out of this thing and we had to take it onto the railway station. We waited there for some time. Eventually the train arrived. We put our kit in the luggage van, got into the train, eventually arrived in Edinburgh. We waited at Edinburgh for several hours before we caught a train from there. And I remember at midnight that night, we were at Crewe. And we eventually arrived down in Devonport, probably late in the afternoon of the day after that.
What happened to you once you got to Devonport?
Well, I did the joining routine like you used to do was given a job to do in the barracks. What did I have to do on that occasion? Oh, I know. I was sent to work in the regulating office. This is where the office allocated all the different jobs for everybody in the department, you know, because there was a lot of people in the barracks at that time. As you can imagine, the barracks was absolutely packed with sailors. We were all in two watches. In other words, we were duty one day and off duty the next. What I mean by that was that Jack Dusties are what they call day workers. They don't keep watches through the night, but they still had to stay on board because they were required for duty on that particular night. If you were duty in the Royal Naval Barracks on the night you were duty down there, you found yourself fire watching down in the torpedo shop in the dockyard or some place like that, you know. You were sent all over the place to do things like that.
And so were you just waiting for a ship?
Yes. I was only there a matter of about I think just over a week when I got a draft ship to be sent to America to pick up the LST. We went across, we travelled up to Glasgow by train. We caught the American trooper. We were put aboard an American trooper. We went across to New York in this trooper. We all came off and we were sent to my draft was called TLS-2. I can't remember how many people that were in it, but it was a big draft, a very, very big draft of people on board that ship, aboard that trooper. When we arrived in New York, we were sent to Brooklyn, and we were put into a place called the Armory, which was a United States Navy place. And we stayed there for a matter of about 10 days. And then we were sent up to a place called Asbury Park. I stayed there for about a week, I think, and then I got sent to Philadelphia to stand by LST-319. And she was being built in a dry dock in Philadelphia Navy Yard. It was a massive dry dock that these ships were built in, and there were six LSTs all being built in that one dry dock at the same time. And they ran from 319 six consecutive numbers up. And the 319, the one that I joined, became the second in command of all British LSTs. Was Commander John Sutton on board as the captain. And LST-320 became the captain LST ship, which is Captain Burgess Watson. He was in charge of all British LSTs.
How did the American people receive you?
Oh, very well indeed. I can't speak more highly of the Americans. They were so hospitable. They really were so hospitable. I corresponded with several people in the States for some time during the war and for some time after the war as well. It was really good. In fact, I ran into a Scottish lady. I was on the train one day. And I met this lady called Mrs. Forbes, and she came from Scotland originally. She was getting on in years. I couldn't say how old she was, but she must have been nearly 70 years of age when I met her on this train. And, of course, she recognized that I was a British sailor, and she struck up a conversation. She still had her Scottish accent, of course. And I eventually met her family. Her son was a doctor. And he lived up at a place called Basking Ridge in New Jersey. And they invited me up there for a weekend. And myself and a chap called Arthur Ball, who also became a Jack Dusty on another LST. In fact, he became the Jack Dusty on Sid Hook's LST.
We should say that I've already interviewed Sid Hook.
That's right, you have already interviewed Sid. Yes, that's right, you have.
When you were standing by this LST, would you have any duties in regard to...
Oh, yes, well, you know, when you're getting ready to commission an LST, especially if you're in the supply department, I mean, each of the ships were given a complement of stores, which is quite a big book. I must say that the Americans fitted out their ships palatially on comparison to ours at the time. And the book that laid down how much gear we had to have was quite big, a massive thing, very good, big, thick thing. And I had to thrash through this one and find out exactly what we were supposed to get from of each of these things. It took me some considerable time before I knew exactly what stores I had to get on board. So that took up most of my time before we were commissioned. And, of course, I had to go around the dockyard to the various stores. And there was a lieutenant commander, an American lieutenant commander, in charge of the routines for us people, the LST, storing. And his office was very helpful. But just to get everything organized, to work out where everything was going to go when it came on board and things like that, it all took a hell of a lot of time.
Can you give some examples of the better facilities which the Americans give?
Oh, yes. I mean, the galley, for instance. The galley was terrific. It was the first... I suppose they were the first ships that had cafeteria messing, the LSTs. They were years ahead of their time as far as the messing was concerned. They had a cafeteria...